for argument, United States versus Nunn. Mr. Karenkowitz.
If you don't mind, I was hit by some bug yesterday evening and my voice is just terrible. So may it please the court, counsel for the government. My name is Robert Karenkowitz, and I represent the appellant, Wallace Nunn. The issue before this court is, did the district court err by finding that two prior felony convictions committed hours apart without an intervening arrest should be counted separately, i.e., should they be treated as related under guidelines purposes? The district court found that these two crimes were separate and distinct, primarily because they were different case numbers, albeit sequential. They were not encompassed in a single indictment. One jury would not have considered both cases simultaneously. The court entered separate sentences on each numbered case.
But I thought the court was also paying attention to the fact that there wasn't a necessary connection between the two. In my own mind, I was contrasting it to some cases that we see where somebody steals a car and then they drive it over to a bank, which they're going to rob, and they put all the loot in the stolen car and zip off, and somehow it all feels like it's really part of the same transaction there, whereas here they steal this Lexus from the guy. And there's no hint that anything in the nature of an assault with the car is going to be necessary. For all we know, he's going to drive the car to within a block of the school. Everybody leaps out and beats up the other gang and jumps back in the car and leaves again, which would mean the second event was totally unrelated.
Yes. And in fact, the stealing the car to rob a bank was going to be one of my hypotheticals.
Okay, well, there we go.
With respect, Your Honor, I think, and maybe I just didn't explain myself properly below, but Your Honor is treating this the way the district court did, in the respect that you're saying to Mr. Nunn, are you telling us that your plan was to steal a car and the next day go run some people over?
Well, actually, no. I'm trying to be a little bit more general about it, and I'm also trying to do it against the backdrop that this is a question of fact, and the question isn't really could we imagine some other answer, but is the one the district court judge chose within the realm of reason. And I would say, you know, was he planning on doing anything with it other than driving it?
Well, I didn't make this argument below or in the briefs, but it comes to mind. Typically, when people steal cars, they do it for a pecuniary reason. They re-tag them, they sell them, they sell them to chop shops.
Or they joyride, you know, at his age.
And sometimes they do. And sometimes they do steal them for transportation. And when one steals a car, again, if you accept my hypothetical, for transportation, then that is the intent in stealing the car. Here's what I think the underlying issue here is. It's confusing to me whether or not Judge Norgal actually credited the facts that I related, i.e., we need wheels to get to our adjoining gang's neighborhood. We want to cause some trouble and get out again. At around pages 18 or 19 of the transcript, he says several times, it's only the argument of counsel. All I'm hearing is the argument of counsel. At pages 21 and 22, I offer three times. I say, well, you know, Mr. Nunn is here. I'm only his counsel. I am stating to this court what my client said to me. Mr. Nunn is prepared to go under oath and testify to these facts and subject himself to cross-examination. Then the court said, well, no, I'm not going to let him contradict the state record. That's at 21. I'm not going to, it's what you're saying to me is not included in the state record. That's at 18 and 19. He says, I'm relying on the historical record, which he defined as the defendant pleaded to two separate and distinct crimes, and then finally said, I'm not going to allow Mr. Nunn to create a new record extemporaneously. However, after having said all that, he does not again say, and everything you said is argument of counsel. Indeed, at the bottom of 21, he does say to me, You have represented by counsel what your client said to you. And typically, represented by counsel is used as a term of art, meaning the court will accept a representation by counsel as having come from the client, as opposed to saying, counsel, all I'm hearing is argument from you. So I'm a little confused myself. I must say this in all candor as to whether or not, in the end, the judge actually credited the facts and then found that they do not rise to common scheme or plan, or whether he continued to disregard the facts, treat them as argument of counsel. At the very bottom of transcript 22, he simply says, I find there's no common scheme or plan. But again, doesn't criticize me for the argument of counsel, but doesn't affirmatively state, I accept the facts as true. So,
could I also, though, comment that it's a rare case, by which I mean I actually can't remember any of them, where the kind of functional consolidation for sentencing in the absence of any kind of formal indication of consolidation on the record has been found to be so compelled by the record, that kind of finding, that we find that. It's much more common that we'll say, here are these two things. Yes, they were very close together in time. Yes, you know, they could be two different drug sales. They could be what happened here. And we normally find that if the district court judge wants to characterize them as two different things with that much time between them, and this is basically overnight from 4 in the afternoon till 9 the next morning, the judge is entitled to view them as two separate cases.
Yeah, and that, in Your Honor, is now referring to my second argument
right.
in the brief, which you understand I make with all due respect. I mean, I am not here, obviously. I'm sorry, Judge, you had a question?
Well, no, I interrupted you. You were trying to answer.
Okay, I just want you to understand, and I'm sure you do, that when I read the cases, when I look at Stahlbaum's comments and the Buford comments and even the comments in Russell, no one seems ever to be able to find this formal order.
We never find functional consolidation, frankly.
And it seems to me, Your Honor, that functional consolidation now begins to impinge on common scheme or plan.
I think it's fair. You know what's weird about your position? So if he rents a Lexus and then goes and runs these people down, you treat that exactly the same as just stealing the Lexus and then running people down.
Well,
because it seems to me, in the second case, this is more serious criminal activity and should lead to a larger sentence enhancement.
Yeah, and Your Honor is now talking about recidivism, and I think that's something to look at. We're dealing with the rare situation where there's one arrest that results in two charges, because
it's rare at all. I don't understand that. I mean, suppose someone, again, he's a thief, and one thief uses a clothes hanger to pick locks, and the other goes and steals a hanger and uses it to pick the locks. There's still going to be the one arrest, but that second person is a worse criminal, and so you'd expect that to lead to the additional sentencing.
Right, and that's certainly a viable argument. The way I see the distinction is because the predicate for even getting to talking about common scheme or plan is no intervening arrest. And I say that it's one thing to have a person arrested, charged with a serious crime, make bond, and go out and commit another serious felony. Buster, you are going to get treated a lot more harshly than someone who's picked up as this fellow was and said, oh, you just had a rumble with these fellas and you bumped into a few of them, and guess what? You're riding a stolen car. It's not as if he got a chance, he was put on his honor, he stands in front of the judge in a bond hearing, Your Honor, I understand the conditions, I promise, and then goes out and commits a serious crime. Then I think the hammer should be dropped. But when it's one arrest and they find out, oh, you did something else too, maybe the recidivism argument isn't quite as strong. If I can save a little time for rebuttal, if there are
Thank
no
you, arguments. Mr. Grant.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson?
Good morning, Your Honors. Leela Johnson on behalf of the United States Council. Your Honor, the defendant has admitted that there was no plan to commit the attempted murder, which was the second crime. So there can be no common scheme or plan with the first crime, which was the stealing of the car. That was admitted by the defendant in the case below, and he also admits it in his reply brief as well as in his main brief. That was never the intent when they stole the car. So you can't have common scheme or plan. Now, the fact that the judge listened, heard what the counsel said, heard the explanation of how this occurred, is clear. The judge specifically asked questions. Are you saying that this was the intent at the time that they stole the car was to try to run somebody over? Counsel said no, and the court moved on and dealt with the other issues that deal with official or functional consolidation, which the court has already recognized.
Isn't that just an illusory doctrine? I mean, I worry about these doctrines floating around out there that are impossible to satisfy. It seems to me that de facto, the only consolidation arguments for sentencing guidelines purposes that are that could prevail are those where there is some official indication on the record, maybe not a formal order of consolidation, but some official indication on the record that the judge is treating the two cases as really all one transaction.
Well, Your Honor, there is a difference because the standard on review is clear error. So whether or not the district court interprets all of these indicia as functional consolidation or not is up to that district court based on the facts. That judge gets to make the determination, and then this court reviews that determination simply to say, was it clear error?
So I if know in we've said that. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. So if in an instance a court acts, the judge actually determines that, okay, even though they had two separate numbers and they were following each other and we have two judgment and convictions order and they received two concurrent sentences, I agree with the defendant that this is one case, it doesn't reach appeal. And there may or may not be any order or case written up, so therefore we don't have the information to sustain the fact that a judge can make that determination. And it's truly up to the judge to determine. So I believe that the case law is one-sided because the defense only complains if the ruling is against them.
Yeah, I was just going to comment. I mean, that may well be true. I mean, there may be a distorted sample of cases up here. The other thing, though, is it's a little funny, although I know we've said it's clear error review, the district court judge is not looking at anything different from what this court would look at. You're looking at some old state court records out there and trying to decide what was the state court doing. So your usual reason for deferring, it sounds to me more like reading a contract, actually, than looking at an actual factual record. The district court isn't doing anything new with the facts. The district court's making an after-the-fact characterization of prior legal proceedings.
I would agree that...
I mean, certainly in this case, this is felon in possession of a firearm, and we're trying to figure out what should his offense level be and what's his criminal history.
And which is determined by how the prior courts made certain decisions.
But we're not deferring here to the state courts, which I could certainly see. If the state courts had made some characterization, then it seems to me they were the ones who had the case. They were the ones who know what they were doing. But they didn't. They just adjudicated.
I'm not sure what the court's
question is. I just don't understand, as I'm thinking about it, why this is an instance in which such strong deference to the district court's characterization of the legal effect of earlier legal acts makes any sense. It may not matter from your point of view, but it's a standard of review question. Don't worry about it. Please, don't worry about it.
Okay.
Anything further? It's important.
No, Your Honor. Just based on the evidence and our arguments, the government respectfully requests that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Kerenkowitz, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Yes, there was one plan here that had two courses of conduct. No, it was not the intent of the parties to run someone over the next day. That's what escalated after the confrontation. And I thought, hopefully I made that plain in my reply brief. Getting back to the formal order and the functional consolidation, I think in all the cases I've read, unless I've overread it, I don't see the court discussing the effect of the safety valve in Application Note 3. And by that I mean if the district court does find consolidation, but then believes that this consolidation resulted in an underrepresentation of a defendant's conduct, the district court is then invited to upward depart. And that was one of the other bases for my argument that again, with all respect, that maybe consolidation should be read more in the lay sense than as a term of art. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Krankowitz. And you were appointed, were you not?
Yes,
so we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client.